A well-informed public is America's greatest security.
The Mutual Broadcasting System, in cooperation with the editors of Newsweek magazine, who believe that a well-informed public is America's greatest security, presents You Make the News, a dramatic analysis of what's behind today's news and what's to be expected in tomorrow.
I've got the depression, prosperity blues, lots of money in the bank, but I can't buy a car. I'm rich, I'm poor. The great white way is browned out.
Last week, the nation found itself gripped by the most fantastic economic plague in its history. Saved up consumer purchasing power had never been so large. Consumer goods never so scarce. Our economy had taken on symptoms both of the boom of the late 20s and the depression of the early 30s, all at the same time. The grim facts of this synthetic depression were...
A substantial part of basic industry shut down or closing.
Upwards of 2 million persons newly unemployed.
Railroad passenger schedules cut 25%.
Chicago offices lighted by candles. New York and other cities browned out.
Business and wage losses running into the millions every day.
And the primary cause of all this was the refusal of a labor leader, John L. Lewis, and a handful of coal operators to agree on a new work contract that would end a six-week-old soft coal strike. The operators have been reported willing to pay a wage increase in line with that granted in other basic industries, but Lewis refused to discuss wages until his primary demand was met, a health and welfare fund to be financed by a royalty on every ton of coal mined and to be controlled by the union. After weeks of negotiations, Lewis suddenly took the floor to trumpet at the startled operators.
Gentlemen, we attended these meetings when you fixed the hour and departed when weariness affected your pleasure. When we emphasized the importance of life, you pleaded the priority of profits. When we spoke of children in unkempt surroundings, you said, look to the state. You profess annoyance at our temerity. We condemn your imbecility. You scorn the toils, the abstinence, the perils of the miner. We withhold approval of your luxurious mode of life and the nights you spend in merriment. No, gentlemen, to argue further is futile. We trust that time, as it shrinks your purse, may modify your niggardly and antisocial propensities. Good day, gentlemen.
Commentating on the Lewis strategy and the soft coal strike, a representative of the coal operators had this to say.
The right of any labor organization to stall and play politics when a basic American industry is shut down is challenged by the operators. And they do not believe that collective bargaining consists of blindly accepting so-called principles arbitrarily laid down by Mr. Lewis and his union.
Whatever might be said about Lewis's bewildering approach to collective bargaining, there is one point on which he is undoubtedly correct. The perils of the miner to which he referred are real.
Oh, my liver and my lungs, my lights and my legs, They're paining me. There is naught but hardship everywhere as on through life I go.
The United States Bureau of Mines figures show that in 14 years, more than 17,000 miners were killed on the job and over 850,000 injured.
There is naught but hardship everywhere as down the mines I go.
And if the public has no love for John L. Lewis, his own men, by and large, appear to have faith in him and in his own peculiar methods. Recently, a reporter assigned to get their side of the story went to one of western Pennsylvania's sprawling mining towns. She walked to the door of a shabby frame house.
Yes? Yes?
You're John Kovacs.
That's right.
I'm doing a story on the strike for my paper. I'd like to talk to you.
Reporter, huh? You won't have anything good to say about us. I'll come in anyway. I got plenty of time.
Thank you.
Come in here, miss. If I...
What's wrong?
Asthma.
Oh, I'm sorry.
We call it miner's asthma.
Are you taking care of it?
Now, this company doesn't take care of us when we get sick on the job. That's why John Lewis wants that welfare fund.
And you think Lewis is going about getting it the right way?
He knows what he wants, and he knows how to get it.
But you'll have to admit he turns most of the company against the miners in the process.
He's a hard man.
And you're all behind him?
Look, miss, I started out making $14 a week. Lewis has got wages raised to $63.50 a week. Now, is there any reason why we shouldn't support
him? All right, but...
And we get vacations and a 35-hour week.
And the men haven't got anything against the way he operates?
Well, there's a lot of us don't like some of the things he does. Some even call him a dictator and worse.
Hmm.
But you got to respect the way he figures things out. And he's got plenty of courage.
And you'll think you'll win this strike?
The strike is just and reasonable. We'll stick it out with John L. and win.
Mm-hmm. About that health and welfare fund, I've heard that Lewis is simply trying to build up a political slush fund.
No, miss. The welfare fund is for the widows and orphans. It's for men who get hurt or can't work. It's got to be. That's what a welfare fund is for.
And you don't think that it would be misused?
I'm not worried, miss. I... You put this in your paper. We want this welfare fund. There's too many men get killed. Too many hurt. Ain't it about time something was done?
Crushed by the days of endless toil and sleepless nights of woe.
Yes, as President Truman has indicated, at least on the score of health and welfare, the miners have a case. If John L. Lewis's tactics seem badly designed to get that case a public hearing, it's not likely he'll mend his ways at this late date. His career has been marked by violence from the beginning. Newsweek reports a typical incident in his stormy life, which took place 40 years ago. In the black depths of a western mine, Lewis was having trouble with a vicious mule named Spanish Pete.
Whoa! Whoa there!
Better watch him, John. He's a bad actor.
Whoa there! Confound you!
Look out! Look out! He will kick your brains out!
Will he? Hand me that club.
Yes. Here. What are you going to do?
I'm going to fix him.
Hey, you knock his brains out. That's not so good. When they find a dead mule, they will fire you, brother.
You think so? Here, a few handfuls of clay rubbed onto his head, and he'll look as good as new. There. See what I mean?
Yes, but wait until the foreman sees what you've done.
What's the matter with you? I'll just tell him Spanish Pete died of heart failure.
In the 40 years since that encounter, Lewis has never hesitated to resort to violence to win an argument. In an unruly convention of the United Miners in the 1920s, John L. Lewis stood on the speaker's platform, thrust out his chest, and...
Silence! Shut up, you! Silence! If there are any delegates who feel inclined to insult the chairman, let them step up here on the platform and try it.
No one did. Then at another meeting, he roared at a man who later became one of his most loyal supporters.
You there, take that gun out of your pocket, or I'll ram it down your throat.
The delegate meekly obeyed. And later, in 1935, he unhesitatingly knocked to the floor Big Bill Hutchison, general president of the United Brotherhood of Carpenters and Joiners, when Hutchison incautiously referred to him in coarse and unprintable terms. Then, last week, with the nation's economy uncomfortably close to collapse, John L. Lewis relented. He announced that the miners would return to work for 2 weeks. But this truce offered only limited relief. Lewis had not changed. In making the announcement of the truce, he ended with a typical flourish. He informed the desperately waiting nation,
"This action
is the contribution of the United Mine Workers of America to our nation's economy, which is being imperiled by the stupidity and selfish greed of the coal operators and associated financial interests, and by demagogues who have tried to lash the public mind into a state of hysteria, rather than grant justice and fair treatment to the men who mine the nation's coal.
Oh, the coal doesn't burn while everyone fiddles, and Johnny Q. Public is caught in the middle.
Yes, there are 2 million unemployed as a result of the shutdown of the coal mines. As John B. Love points out in Newsweek, we are confronted by the paradoxical situation of a synthetic depression in the midst of plenty.
Just a minute, Bud.
Huh?
I don't like to interrupt this now fancy talk of yours, see, but a lot depends on what kind of colored glasses you're wearing.
Colored glasses?
Yeah. Mine are strictly from rose color.
Would you mind telling me who you are?
Well, I'm just a character that hangs around Broadway and other places. Uh-huh. My friends call me the Duke. So do my enemies, so it don't make much difference where you sit.
All right, Duke. What's all this about colored glasses?
Well, I hear you giving out this line about a depression. Me, I have to keep pinching myself these days to be sure I'm awake. Incidentally, the reason I'm wearing this shirt with the pinstripes ain't on account of you can't buy a white shirt. I happen to like it.
I see. Well, that's fine. Yeah. I'm still waiting to find out about the glasses, remember?
Oh, yeah. You talk about a depression. 2 weeks ago, I'm at Churchill Downs. They're running the Derby, which is pronounced Derby if you come from the other side of the tracks. The other side from me, I mean.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Over $1 million is bet on that one race alone, which sets a new world's record. That don't sound like no depression to me, especially since I have $50 on a nag named Assault, which wins by 8 lengths, which gets me back roughly 450 clams for my 50.
Mm-mm.
Catch on about the colored glasses? Life is wonderful.
Yeah, it does sound as though the people in the racing business are doing all right.
Well, last Saturday, they shift from Louisville to Baltimore to run the Preakness. The Derby is called the Run for the Roses. The Preakness, the Run for the Black-Eyed Susans, which is really dyed daisies. The horsemen shift from Bourbon to Rye, and they sing Maryland, My Maryland, instead of My Old Kentucky Home. But the scenario goes about the same. The horses come to the gate. I ain't betting on Assault this time, on account of you gotta put up 5 clams to get yourself 3 back. It ain't any skin off my nose, but my blood pressure stays up just the same. Since there ain't any dough involved, I am now a horseman watching a horse. Like in Kentucky, this Assault starts kind of slow from the gate. He's in the ruck until they hit the stretch. And then he starts coming. He pulls into a 3-length lead, and it looks like he's in. A nag called Lord Boswell starts to push him a little, and a jockey on Assault lays on with the bat. For a minute, I think Assault is going to jump into the bleachers. He just does manage to nose out Lord Boswell. You talk about depression? This Assault collects, get this, $195,000 for winning them 2 races.
Mm-mm. Well, those certainly aren't poorhouse figures.
Maybe there's a kind of inflation in it, though, at that.
Huh?
You see, Assault's pappy, Bold Venture, won them same 2 races 10 years ago and only collects 65 G's for the both of them. But me, my glasses are strictly rose-colored.
The races, they're played by the masses, while depressions make passes at rose-colored glasses.
Well, the Duke isn't far wrong. Certainly, anyone looking at the sports picture in America today can see no symptoms of depression. Although the baseball season is scarcely a month old, something like an attendance record for 3 games was set at the Yankee Stadium this week in a hot series between the Boston Red Sox and the New York Yankees. More than 175,000 people paid their money to see those 3 games in spite of threatening weather.
Take me out to the ball game.
Meanwhile, in the background, emissaries of the Mexican League are offering astronomical figures to American ballplayers to break their contracts and travel south of the border to play. Larry McPhail, president and general manager of the Yankees, sought injunctions against the owners of the Mexican League and sports writer Rudd Rennie of the New York Herald Tribune.
This man Rennie has gone right into the Yankee dressing room with propositions to my players on behalf of Mexico.
Tongue-in-cheek, John Lardner, sports columnist of Newsweek, comments on the charge against Rennie.
I am empowered to state at this time that Rennie was merely an innocent decoy in the operation. While he was in the Yankee dressing room trying to get a recipe for spaghetti with clam sauce from Joe DiMaggio, a small party of true agents, headed by your correspondent, took the rest of the Yankees aside and offered them $500,000 a year apiece for 5 years to play in Mexico, with a $2 million bonus for signing. One of the players, whose name I'll not mention for fear of jeopardizing his job, asked for Mexico itself, saying he would not play for anything less than they gave Cortez. Since Mexico has already been promised to a batting practice pitcher on the Philadelphia Phillies, we were not in a position to make the deal.
Oh, boy, yes. Sports are definitely on the boom, and the public is hungry to watch and hear about sports. Last week in Pompton Lakes, New Jersey, Stan Lomax, veteran sports commentator for the Mutual Network, pulled a stunt for his listeners.
Boy, and what a stunt. This Lomax is going into the ring with Joe Louis. See, he's going to box with Louis and at the same time broadcast how it feels.
You'll be sorry.
This Lomax has an idea a lot of fighters should have had before, maybe. He wears a reinforced catcher's mask inside of which is a lip microphone. Also, he has on a chest protector and shin guards. He has on bright purple oversized silk shorts, which makes his legs look like two toothpicks covered with white enamel paint.
You'll be sorry.
They go out in the center of the ring, and Lewis starts tapping gentle-like on the catcher's mask. I guess every time this happens, it sounds over the air like Lomax's jaw is being broke. Finally, Lomax takes a quick pratfall and an about. I guess he still don't know how it feels.
Oh, announcers, announcers, such nerve, such aplomb. Soon they'll broadcast from inside the atomic bomb.
Lord, I was born about 3 o'clock in the afternoon with a white head and something of a round belly. For my voice, I have lost it with hallowing and singing of anthems. To approve my youth further, I will not. The truth is, I am only old in judgment and understanding, and he that will caper with me for 1,000 marks, let him lend me the money and have at him.
So spoke Sir John Falstaff on the stage of the Century Theater in New York City. Theatrical history was made last week when the Old Vic Repertory Theater from London opened in New York to the acclaim of the critics.
Hey, Mac, get a load of the line of people. Must be 7-8 blocks long.
It must be nylons.
No, I don't think so. Come on, let's take a gander. See what's cooking.
Okay. Holy smoke.
Hey, look at that. Shakespeare.
Perhaps we are confronted with a synthetic depression, but there were no signs of it at the Century Theater last week. There might not be manufactured goods on which people could spend their ready cash, but entertainment of high caliber could ask almost any price. $12 a seat for the opening night at the Old Vic deterred no one at all. Seats for the 6 weeks of repertory simply cannot be had. More than $50,000 passed through the box office the first week. No signs of a depression here.
Oh, they went to see Shakespeare at 12 bucks a seat, but in school, William Shakespeare, they never did read. Soon one morning, death come creeping in my room. Soon one morning, death come creeping in my room.
Like most depressions, the present one, even though it is synthetic, has been accompanied by an increase in crime. In New Iberia, Louisiana, an apprehended criminal was about to pay the penalty for his crime, murder.
Soon one morning, Death come creeping in my room. Oh, my Lord, oh, my Lord, what shall I do to be saved?
17-year-old Willie Francis, sentenced to die for murdering a druggist, was about to be electrocuted when something went wrong.
What went wrong, Frank?
Short circuit, Warden, I guess. That confounded wire burned out.
How's Willie Francis?
Okay, he's back in his cell. He says it didn't do any more than tickle.
Later, in his jail cell, Willie Francis clutched his prayer book tight and stopped humming a spiritual long enough to say,
"The Lord was with me last night, and he's with me now."
Soon one morning, death come creeping in my room. Oh, my Lord, oh, my Lord, what shall I do to be saved?
8 miles away in their ramshackle cottage, Willie's family laughed and cried for joy. The hired hearse and the tombstone bought with borrowed money were for the moment forgotten. Then another electrocution was ordered. But by failing to die on schedule, Willie had aroused legal interest throughout the nation. To his defense came a local lawyer, a longtime friend of the man Willie killed. He insisted,
"The official argument that the court ordered electrocution until dead and that the date doesn't matter is poppycock. The second execution can't take place. How many times does a man have to go to the chair to atone for his crime?"
Louisiana's acting governor, Emil Verre, granted a stay of execution. As the state Supreme Court began studying the case, Willie's lawyer cited a legal precedent. He recalled the case of Willie Purvis, who in 1894 escaped hanging when the noose slipped.
Come listen, all you people, come listen to my tale concerning Willie Purvis, who was wrongly sent to jail. They put him on the scaffold and the trap it was sprung. From the hand of God it saved him, and Willie never hung. Oh, it's Willie never hung. Willie never hung. The thickest rope it split and broke, and Willie never hung. 25 years thereafter, a certain man confessed that he had done the crime which had caused Willie's arrest. And everyone gave thanks with many a hymn and song. For the hand of God had saved him, and Willie never hung. Oh, it's Willie never hung. Willie never hung. The thickest rope it split and broke, and Willie never hung.
Yes, there is a synthetic depression confronting the country, but the students of Smith College in Northampton, Massachusetts, don't seem to be frightened by it. Last February, Professor of Economics Stanley Ross started something on the quiet Northampton campus.
Women own or control 65% of the nation's wealth. Yet many of them do not have practical knowledge of investment or finance. As a step toward remedying that, I am suggesting to this class that you form an investment company to get practical experience.
The girls jumped at the idea and incorporated under Massachusetts law. They proposed to offer 5,000 shares at $1 each to relatives and friends, but a hitch arose in the Securities and Exchange Commission.
I'm sorry, Miss Miller, but the rules don't allow you to incorporate for $5,000.
But that's ridiculous. After all, this is simply a practical experiment.
The rules require at least $50,000 of capital.
Well, then we must make a special appeal to the commission for exemption from all its rules.
Last week, the SEC hearing on the application set a record. 4.5 minutes.
Since there are no objections from the SEC staff, the appeal from the Smith College girls for exemption from the rules is granted.
And so the Smithies are now free to risk their shirts.
I got a daughter, and she goes to Smith. She's the kind of a daughter I'm delighted with. She formed a corporation. Now she sends me an allowance.
One word which has frightened the American people during this paradoxical situation of depression and boom is inflation. But inflation holds little terror for Alvin H. Hansen of Harvard University. With the death of Lord Keynes last month, he succeeded to world leadership of Keynesian economics, a school which takes deficit finance, managed currency, and low interest in its stride. Hansen, whose green eye shade makes him look like a newspaper copy reader, spoke his mind last week to newspaper men at the Harvard reunion.
You care to make any prophecy about the future, Mr. Hansen?
Well, I'll have to hedge a little.
Well, go ahead and hedge.
Well, my prophecies are predicated on the continuance of high taxes, retained savings, and price controls until scarcities are overcome.
Well, if all those continue, what do you see in your crystal ball, Mr. Hansen?
The strength of collective bargaining will not permit a profits inflation. The surest way of going into a tailspin.
What about the $225 billion of savings the American people have put away?
There's no reason to believe we can't handle that much money. In fact, within 20 years, we shall probably need twice as much.
You don't think that much money lying around is bound to increase the cost of everything?
The whole history of our country has proved that as productivity and income rose, we have needed vaster supplies of money. Over the long run, a country as productive as the United States is far more in danger of not having buyers for its products than of inflation.
Oh, the experts, they sure know the dirt, but I still wish I knew how to buy a white shirt.
So, as the American people are confronted with a strange mixture of depression and boom, they ask, what can be done about it? They've had a belly full of strikes. The United States Senate talked mightily about the coal strike last week, but took no action. They threatened anti-labor legislation, but at the end of the week, it was still no more than a threat. And the president? Well, the highlights of President Truman's week included a speech denouncing moron motorists who imperil highway safety.
I got the depression prosperity blues.
A quiet birthday observance, the president's 62nd. And a gift from his daughter Margaret, a sculptured replica of her hand.
Lots of money in the bank, but I can't buy a car.
And an honorary college degree from Fordham University in New York City, the president's 7th since entering the White House.
I'm rich, I'm poor, how are you? I'm snafu.
Yes, the nation is in the grip of a fantastic economic plague. Wealth and poverty, employment and unemployment, plenty and scarcity. The teamwork which made our magnificent war effort possible is missing. Individuals and groups are no longer pulling together. The result is confusion. There is no easy solution. In the last analysis, the cure will lie with a public which has armed itself with the facts. A public which refuses to let itself become bewildered. A public which speaks with a clarity of judgment which only knowledge can provide. Such an informed public can exert democratic pressures for the solution of each of the problems involved. And so, whether we sink deeper into a state of limping confusion, or whether we start working together toward a full life and economic security, is, in the long run, up to you who make the news.
Broadcast next week will be our last in this series, but we'll be back in the fall. In the meantime, listen next week at the same time over many of these stations when the Mutual Broadcasting System, in cooperation with the editors of Newsweek magazine, who believe that a well-informed public is America's greatest security, will again present You Make the News. You Make the News is a Phillips Leader Seymour production. Stats Cotsworth is the narrator. The music is composed and conducted by Alexander Semmer. The songs were adapted and sung by Tom Glazer. This is the Mutual Broadcasting System.